Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight, ready to reload this week's news. Ah, we got a great panel. I'm so excited. Kristen McQuarrie's here. Hi, Kristen. Good to see you.
Hey, Justin. How you doing?
Editorial board member for the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, I was thinking, Kristen, it was about 2+ years ago that you were on with us, right when the State House missed the first deadline for budget stuff. And I remember this because we had a couple of lawmakers call in, and you were great. You just yelled at them. And I was just like,
That's what I do.
Yeah, that's what you do. And I was like, yeah, this will get rectified in a day.
Yeah. No, not quite a day.
Two years and change, and you're back. Good to see you, Chris.
Yes, you too.
And also in the chair, David Greising, the Midwest Bureau Chief for Reuters. Good to see you, David. How are you?
Good, Justin. Good to be here.
All right.
Yeah.
David and I have worked together. Yeah. Chris and I have worked together. It's great to have this team together.
Yeah.
All right. So as we tonight, this is how we play, 312-981-7200. We got biggest stories, we got overreported, underreported, winners, losers, which story sucked you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered from this week in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from now. Let's start with the biggest story. I think we all probably agree that the budget for the state of Illinois, the override, everything that happened over the 4th of July holiday, the biggest story of the week. Do we all agree on that?
I did.
Pretty hard to argue with that
one. I did.
Yeah.
What's your take?
Huge income tax hike.
Yeah, I mean, what's your take, Kristen? I mean, you guys at the Tribune have written a lot about the impact and also the culture in Springfield. I mean, what happened here? This is 2+ years of holdouts and pushes for reforms, and we're kind of where we started.
We do. It feels that way, doesn't it? I feel like I wrote an editorial this week that I could have written when I was working for David Greising in 2011 at the Chicago News Cooperative. So it's a big moment, and it was my biggest story of the week because the tax hike is in effect. If you live in the state, if you pay income taxes, you are now paying instead of 3.75%, you're paying 4.9%. That is real money to a lot of people. If you're a single person and you make $34,000 a year, that's an extra $386. If you're a family, maybe making $150,000 a year, you're paying almost an extra $1,700 to the state of Illinois into perpetuity. So the fact that we have a big tax hike is a big story. But also, we finally broke this budget impasse that has made us a national embarrassment. And we didn't really get a lot of the reform that the Governor Bruce Rauner was asking for. So in my opinion, that's both of those issues, the political side and the financial side, made it the biggest.
Well, let's
story.
Talk about it, David. I mean, let's first talk about the financial side. I mean, this was a tax hike that was sort of sunset by Speaker Madigan 2 years ago after Governor Rauner said he wasn't going to support it when he first took office. And we're kind of back there. We're back there with the income tax back to where it was, right around the same level. And like Kristen said, none of the reforms that Governor Rauner was pushing for were in this budget.
No, and that's a sign of his weakness politically, but it's also a sign of what kind of killed me this week was watching the celebration on the floor, the self-congratulation on the part of Speaker Madigan and others. Look what happens. We've come together and kind of stepping into their kind of statesman roles when really what have they done? They basically said, well, wait, we need more money. Look around. Where can we find more money? Oh, there's all these taxpayers. Let's go get more money from them. And they haven't really fixed anything. The pension issue is, of course, the biggest financial issue facing the state. And there's no real structural long-term fixes to the pension problem. And so they're really still, as they always have done, kicking the can down the road. They don't have any ideas. The governor, though, hasn't shown that he has any ideas either. He's raised things that are kind of just not really relevant. You know, his push for workman's comp, limitation on workman's comp settlements, et cetera. Some of the stuff he's kind of thrown into the mix has just not been relevant. And that's one of the reasons I think Springfield ultimately said, listen, Governor, whatever, we'll do this, you know, we got this, we'll do this without you. A bunch of Republicans took the risk of voting override his veto. We'll see what sort of price they pay for that. It's really dramatic, event, but in terms of long-term fixes, we're left kind of waiting to see when and if that'll ever come.
Yeah, I'm flummoxed a little bit over this because you're right. You hit it right on the head. This is something that could have been written about in 2011, but it definitely could have been a vote that happened in 2015. I mean, we saw a governor who really, I mean, the argument, Kristen, and you guys have been front and center with this at the editorial board, is this difference between budgetary items and ideology. Mm-hmm. And we have seen this over and over about that the governor said these need to be a part of the budget. They're not separate. Democrats have said they're separate, yet they have been at stalemate for 2 years. And we get to the end of this thing where we think there's going to be some change, and they're still separate.
Mm-hmm.
I think as someone who is a citizen in the state of Illinois, I'm flummoxed about what they actually did for the last 2 years.
It was really a battle of egos between a Republican governor and House Speaker Michael Madigan. And I mean, our editorial board tends to favor the side of the newcomer, which is the governor who's been in office 2.5 years, not the guy who's been speaker since 1983, except for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so it was really from the beginning, from our position, I mean, Governor Rauner came in. He had 44 bullet points that he wanted to accomplish. Some of them, he got none of them. And really, for the first couple of years, Madigan just was the guy of no. Sent him budgets that were hugely out of balance that he had to veto. I'm not saying the governor is not at fault for failure of leadership, for moving the goalposts a lot, for being unclear as to what he really wanted. But to me, this is more of a show of the absolute power of the speaker and the Democratic leader of the Senate. In they're not going to give him a win. They're not going to give him even workers' comp reform to the extent that the governor asked for, which small and large business owners alike all over the state are saying, please help us. You know, we've seen the outflow of businesses and residents, and they're so resistant to even a change like that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get property tax. They didn't get a property tax freeze. It does feel like 2011. This was Governor Quinn's plan. Please extend the tax increase. They did a tax increase with no reform.
Now Democrats will say, "Hey, we cut six whatever billion or whatever the number
$3 billion
yeah. out of this." This isn't a bloated. This is actually less of what the number than the governor actually wanted. So what about the concept of Governor Rauner with this idea of pushing ideological reforms? It did work in a certain extent that we got some cuts done in Springfield.
Well, I guess the question is, where does the credit for that go? And I'm not sure that the governor, by basically not really participating in the negotiating process, gets much credit for that. On the other hand, I'm loath to give a lot of credit to Speaker Madigan. Maybe John Cullerton, the president of the Senate, is probably, of all of the major players down there, the one who really worked this the hardest, mm-hmm. Kind of threw out some ideas, some that were good and some that were less good. He was the big pusher, a big pusher behind this whole grand bargain idea that kind of ultimately did lead to this resolution. It was interesting to see Speaker Madigan go to the Senate the day that they voted it through on the Senate to kind of try to kind of step into the spotlight along with Cullerton. So that at least showed a little bit of political leadership, and maybe that's something to build on. I don't know. Going back to your initial question is like, okay, well, what has changed or what does this build toward? We don't have any working relationship right now between the governor and the two legislative leaders still. There aren't any kind of agreed agenda items that need to be taken up next. It's not very promising.
Okay. So here, I mean, we go right into here. We come into August, which is the traditional kickoff for a gubernatorial campaign with what's going to happen at the Illinois State Fair. Well, who's the political winners and losers here? I mean, the governor quickly at the end, and we were kind of talking about this last night on the show. Quickly, I mean, if you're an educated voter, you recognize he's been pushing for he knew a tax increase was coming and he was trying to get something out of it. So it's a little bit disingenuous to turn around and say, I would not vote for this taxes. The Democrats raise your taxes. He was going to do the same thing if he would have gotten something in return. But he's going to run on that. He's going to run on the idea that the Democrats raised your taxes. They just want to take all of the money they can. I'm the reform candidate. Is that going to stick?
You know, it might. And you're right, it is disingenuous because as a candidate, he ran saying he was open to, I think he put 32 service tax hikes on the table. He was open to a shorter extension of the tax hike that was in place in 2011. A couple of weeks before they signed this deal, Republicans came out with a compromise plan that included a tax hike. So this outrage that there was, I think he wanted it. He wanted this. It released a huge pressure valve on his administration. So, yes, he has that one thing to run on. I blocked the Democrats from raising your taxes. But that's it. he didn't get any of his other reforms. So I actually think in terms of winners and losers, they both came out winners. Madigan did too, because he can come out and say, the governor stood on the sidelines. We at least saved the state. We got a budget in place. He's been the person, you know, responsible for the impasse. And isn't that what prognosticators said all along, that in order to break the impasse, they both sort of had to come out with a win? And sort of they did.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Well, the real killer, the one that would have made all of them a loser, would have been, and may yet happen, the downgrade to junk status for Illinois' credit rating. It may yet happen. Moody's, which has put Illinois on credit watch, has not yet said what it's going to do. And one of our reporters at Reuters talked to one of the analysts at Moody's who was indicating that this bill itself, they're not really wowed by it. And so that'll be interesting to see. But when you look at it, if there was no deal and the state went into junk status, then Rauner clearly loses because he wears the junk status.
I think so.
Yeah.
Governor Junk, right?
Right, Governor Junk. And so Rauner can come out, Governor Rauner can come out and say, look, the Democrats raise your taxes and I've preserved the state's credit rating or something, you know, who knows what. But I think that in a sense, he gets a little bit of both. He gets maybe to avoid the junk status, but he gets to rail against the means by which the state mm-hmm. would avoid the junk status. Mm-hmm. So he gets a little bit of both. So in a sense, he has something to go with there. And I think voters will not remember some of the finer points that Kristen is pointing to about, well, he was behind a lot of these.
Well, if they read the editorial page, David.
Before we move on, you covered business for the Tribune for a long time, business columnist, of course, with Reuters as well. I mean, as a journalist who's covered the business landscape here in the state of Illinois, to hear that Moody's wants to downgrade the state to junk, what does that mean to you? I mean, is that spectacular in your mind? Are you like, yeah, this is, I've never heard anything like this? Or is it sort of, no, that's normal. That's 2017 for you.
Well, you know, 5-10 years ago, I never would have imagined it. I remember, speaking of going back to my days at the Tribune 15-20 years ago, I remember some of the do-gooders in town, the business leaders of town, coming to the editorial board and saying, well, if we don't start paying our pensions, you know, someday this is going to be a big problem. And it is a really big problem, and the pension underfunding over many, many years, 20-some years at least, is what has put us in the position we're in. The impact on business is, first of all, the embarrassment of being associated with this sort of political dysfunction. And it makes, when you talk to business leaders, they're concerned because it really makes it hard for them to figure out, they think in long-term 5-year, 10-year, 15-year investments. It's hard to figure out like what things will look like in Illinois that far down the mm-hmm. the line. Can they get good people to come to work here when they're paying 25% of their income to mm-hmm. taxes, et cetera? It's just, there are all kinds of issues that they think about. But I never would have imagined it would be the first time in history that a state achieved a junk rating.
We're very
excited about that. Junk, yeah, yeah. So
they could take down the Abraham Lincoln statue here,
sure,
and put a junk statue. 224 says the silver lining of the budget stalemate: 2 years without a tax increase. So there you go. That's
okay.
Okay, we got okay. Kristen McQuarrie, David Greising in studio. We're reloading this week's news. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get to winners and losers next here on The Download. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news here on The Download. David Greising, Kristen McQuarrie in studio. 312-981-7200. We went through the biggest story of the week, which is Springfield. We continue on that thread. Let's go to winners and losers. We'll start with winners. David, you got winners, Republicans who voted to override the veto.
Yeah, and I have in mind, people like Reggie Phillips from Charleston, which has Eastern Illinois University in the district. And it takes some nerve or some self-interest possibly to vote against the governor of your party. He said, basically, I'm voting my district. These are the big jobs in my district. And I'd be a fool.
Because that's where Eastern Illinois
right,
was.
Yeah. Right, mm-hmm. right. So, that's when you think about kind of what our representative democracy is all about. You should represent the people you are sent to whatever legislative chamber
politically
you're sent to.
What does it mean? I mean, what's it mean if I forgot what the number was, 10, 12, 14, whatever the number of Republican House members who voted for the override. What does it mean? I mean, politically? Are they going to have challengers in the primary? Is there going to be retribution? What does it mean?
So.
You think
yeah,
so?
I do. I agree with David that in some of these districts, maybe not all, they were torn. I mean, Reggie Phillips represents Eastern Illinois University. He's a small business owner. He's really fiscally conservative. He term limited himself, so this was actually his last term. He's a thoughtful guy, and he was supported for his election by some of these right-wing groups, and now they are after him. He has a target on his back. I wouldn't say all of them. I don't know that 15 Republicans needed to break mm-hmm. in order to give cover for the Democrats to pass this tax increase. But I think, yeah, you're going to see a lot of them primaried, because all of this stuff that we're talking about tonight, none of it will really register with voters, but they will notice when $1,200, $1,300, $1,400 is missing from their wallets and going to fund what continues to be dysfunction in Springfield.
What about the Democrats? I mean, do you see, you know, because Governor Rauner is going to run on this concept of the Democrats raised your taxes. Do you think that Democrat House members, even senators, might have more trouble in re-election campaigns based on the fact that there's going to be an attack at those seats on the idea that they raise taxes?
A few, but not really. The Democrats have controlled the map of legislative districts, and it's so powerful. In 2011, we had a 67% tax increase that lasted 4 years. Not a single Democrat lost a seat based on their vote for that tax hike. Not one. In fact, the House and Senate got super majorities in 2012 under the new map after they voted for a 67% income tax hike. So, no, I don't see this being as risky for Democrats
right.
as it is for Republicans.
Yeah, under unintended consequences, if the governor does seek retributions and puts up primary opponents against that dozen or so who voted against his veto, whomever wins those races will come out as a weakened candidate, having gone through a primary, and maybe more vulnerable against a decent Democratic candidate. So
might go the other way, yeah.
Right, it would be ironic if they lost some of those Republican seats because of the intra-party battle.
This, I guess, is the part, and this I'm glad to have you guys in the studio to enlighten me here, but what gets me is that it is a Democrat-controlled legislature, both in the Senate and the House. They have, and they have to wear where we're at all the trouble there's been in the last couple decades because they've been in charge. But they get to set the agenda because they have the majority parties, and in this case are able to sort of stall the government when a governor comes in, Governor Rauner comes in, he says, I want reforms or you're not going to get a budget. They, just as you just said, Kristen, they don't see a challenge. There's no challenge back in their districts. So they could just sit on it. And that's what they did. They just sat on it till Republicans got, you know, started to sweat and said, my districts downstate are losing money. And, you know, they were able, it's almost like they won in this battle of attrition. Like you said, this political ego game of chicken that was played. But because the maps are so strong towards Democrats, there doesn't seem to be any competition for those seats. So they don't have to worry about risk.
I mean, that is my opinion, and I'm allowed to say that because I write for the opinion page. I don't see how you can, after decades of sending budgets over to whoever was in charge. I mean, the democratically controlled legislature sent unbalanced budgets to Rod Blagojevich, to Pat Quinn. It didn't matter. If you're going to divvy up blame, which we love to do on the editorial page, it's hard for us to put more blame on a governor who's been there for 2.5 years when as soon as he walked in the door, they basically gave him the middle finger. I mean, he didn't get anything. There was no honeymoon period. Madigan wouldn't even meet with him a lot of times during those first 6 or 8 months that he was in office. The first budget they sent him was $4 billion out of balance. And Madigan said, well, we know this is not constitutionally balanced. I mean, they never gave him a chance to even accomplish some of
this. And yet you'll hear Democrats say we're protecting the you know, voters who are less fortunate, people who need social services, others in case and Governor Rauner is a pro business, you know, he wants to break the unions. They will say they did that to protect their constituency.
Well, but going back to Kristen's point, when you go back 25 years, were they protecting those workers by underfunding their pensions? Were they protecting those workers by building up in the last couple of years and $15 billion budget deficit that needs to be repaid through taxes yeah. that are levied on these very same people that they're supposedly protecting. So They do bear a lot of this responsibility.
My other winner would be the city of Chicago in this, because, you know, it's being bashed over and over and over in the last couple of weeks, you know, with the word bailout and others, this sort of anti-Chicago backlash going around the state talking about Chicago is fiscally irresponsible. We got everything that was on the table. Rahm Emanuel walked out with he might have money for schools, but there's more in this budget. I mean, it just seems like even pension.
He got the pension stuff settled.
I mean, yeah. It's interesting that Chicago, for all of that was happening, that backlash that was happening, they came out sort of looking good.
He did. I mean, the big question mark, though, is they don't have money for Chicago public schools yet. Rauner has to sign this very controversial school funding bill in order for CPS to get this rescue that it needs. But you're right. They got pension relief. He got 911 fees to help supplement some of the pensions. That's what happens when you have a Democratic legislature. And those weren't bad bills to begin with. So.
And Mayor Emanuel was criticized for not going down to Springfield. And it looks like that was probably the right decision. He may have lost more votes by going down.
Yeah, right.
So he got his agenda taken care of by having proxies down there and not doing it himself.
Well, we just did the winners. We're going to turn our attention to the losers, because Mayor Emanuel also shows up in that category with his strange fight with the New York Times, the New York media that happened over mass transit. David Greising, Kristen McQuarrie in studio tonight. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, in studio tonight, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We got a lot of great calls and texts that are coming in. In studio, David Greising, he's the Midwest Bureau Chief for Reuters. Kristen McQuarrie, she's the editorial board member for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for being here tonight. As we've already done biggest story, which said Springfield, winners, which we stayed on Springfield. Let's do losers. I really want to talk to you guys. I've been looking for someone to talk to about the op-ed that Mayor Emanuel put in the New York Times about mass transit. He did it at the beginning of this week, right in the cover of the 4th of July holiday. I think it was on the 3rd, maybe it was over the weekend. But it was essentially this idea that Chicago gets a bad rap for a lot of different things, but we do great with transit.
Mm-hmm.
And we should fund transit infrastructure because we're great at it. But the context was in the middle of two big cities, Washington, D.C. and New York, that are having serious trouble with transportation.
He took pot shots at them.
He did. Yeah. It was like, right, out of nowhere. Like,
kick them when they're down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's in their paper. I mean, right. it really was sort of, you know, a guy who scores a touchdown at an opposing field and does a really sort of really over the top end zone dance. Like, it really felt that way. And the New York media did not take kindly. The next day there were headlines and op-eds against him in the city. What do you guys think? I mean, I put him in the loser category because I don't know if he knew he was going to get this kind of backlash, but it just made all of Chicago go, oh, what are you doing, dude?
I mean, to me, it's one of these moments like, who is around you telling you this is a good idea? Who is not? Who are you surrounding yourself with people who are telling you, Mayor, this is going to be a bad idea because we're weak? Okay, our trains are on time, but yeah, right. 104 people got shot over the weekend. So to me, he teed it up for them to just whack him. And so I don't know if it's his ego, if people around him aren't, if he doesn't like to be challenged, and so he has staff who just kind of do what he says. But I thought it was an obvious, huge error on his part.
Is there a strategy to it? Maybe. Well, maybe there's some strategy.
Some stubbornness to him, to this one, because we had an interview with him about a month or so ago, and he brought up out of nowhere how great the transportation system is in the city of Chicago. This has obviously been something that he feels like he has invested a lot of political capital and such in improving the mass transit system, and he's not getting any credit for it, and he's not going to get credit locally. So he thought, well, we'll go to this to the New York Times and see if maybe they'll let me kind of use up some space. So it's interesting that he just feels like, hey, this is a big one. This is a big win for me. Look what I've done. And the only way to get attention. But like you say, Kristen, he just didn't think, okay, will this open me up to any trouble? And I like how the Daily News, the New York Daily News, put him on its cover with a really unflattering picture.
He put him on the
cover.
The
headline, Dumb Track Mind. So, yeah, not one of his finer
moments. I guess maybe he's being talked about in the national spotlight. Maybe it's a Chris Christie kind of thing where any press is press or whatever, like whatever it is. But I don't know what he was doing.
I really think having watched this mayor, it's just he's tone deaf in a lot of ways. And this is one of them. Do you think that you're not, especially, I mean, we fight over who has the best pizza. We write editorials back and forth about that kind of stuff. You think you can take a shot at some of these transportation systems and they're not going to take a really powerful shot back? One of the headlines was, well, at least our commuters don't get shot on the way home. The Mayor Emanuel has failed to recognize from day one that crime is going to be his legacy. That's his as we stand right now.
You can
do your speeches in Washington, D.C., and you can talk to the press club, and you can fly to Canada, and you can do all this stuff, and you can be on CNN as a political pundit. Great. You had 104 shootings over July 4th weekend. That is appalling. And everyone else in the country gets it.
And it's becoming, I mean, a national storyline because of the way that the president's approached it, using Twitter to call out that this is something that is unacceptable in Chicago. I mean, I put that in the loser category as well. I mean, the 4th of July weekend, a really weird anomaly where 3 days they seem to be on top of it. In the last 12 hours of the weekend, 42 people.
They did a little victory dance with the press conference before, the 4th, and, you know, saying, look at all these guns we've seized, et cetera. And then in that next 12 hours, things just completely blow up. To get a sense of perspective, the last time that we had one of these four-day July 4th weekends, there were 74 shootings. And that was 2013. So the increase is almost 40% increase in the number of shootings that happened over a similar four-day period. So that gives you some sense of how much they've lost control over what's going on in the streets. And then, of course, the other thing is where these shootings happen. And of those 100-some shootings, the bulk of them happened, again, late on the 4th. I think like one of them happened north of North Avenue.
Right.
And it's kind of a segregation, and, economic segregation.
I guess I put in the loser category too, and I don't mean this for any of the officers, but the Chicago Police Department, they were talking about a strategy, implementing a strategy that they used on Memorial Day weekend. They made a lot of hay of that at the press conference as well, this concept that they had a way to take on violence and it's working. And then to see it not work in the way that there's a 40% increase, that's a bad look for the Chicago Police Department strategy.
It is. They're frustrated too. I think that was the Tribune's headline. They're frustrated all around. You know, there was a front page photo either July 4th or July 5th of police officers, you know, like grasping some of these victims' families, and they are affected by it just as much.
And then, you know, the idea of when things go bad, they then get even worse. They've got this new technology, the shot spotter technology that was supposed to be
one of the magic fixes.
And it was faked out by fireworks that people were putting out on the street. Mm-hmm. Every time they heard something explode, they thought it was a shot. And so that system proved to be completely useless. And that's just one of those cases where when things go bad, they go really, really bad.
They really do. I mean, there was a lot of hope. I mean, there was a lot of hope around this 4th of July weekend. What do you do if you're the Chicago police, the mayor? I mean, a good point to be writing about mass transit, the tone-deaf part you mentioned. I mean, to be writing about that when the city is having this issue, a 40% increase from the last four-day weekend. What do you do? I mean, obviously the feds are coming in, ATF data agents and others that are coming in. There seems to be more interest in trying to get the federal government to help out. But what is it? Does the mayor, like you said, his legacy is crime. Does he double down, or does he recognize that it's not a winnable? It's just not a winnable issue.
I really don't think he's tried. I mean, if I were mayor, I mean, the day that he came in, these hotspots should have been his primary focus. I don't care about the Riverwalk. I really don't. I don't care about Navy Pier. Really don't. Crime everywhere in the city affects every part of the city. Why wasn't he having caucus meetings, a special caucus with all of the aldermen who represent these areas? Why weren't there connections made between Northside aldermen and what they can do to help bring businesses to Southside neighborhoods? I mean, this is all, a lot of it is economic development and jobs, and he's been really slow to try to make some of these connections, and it should have been priority number one. Crime was bad when he was elected. And I feel like this whole idea of, we have 50 wards in the city, and aldermen who are in charge of a few square miles and get paid a lot of money to keep track of them. the silos in this city should have been broken down on day one, and you should have had meetings with, what can Brendan Riley, where we're sitting, do for Kerry Austin in the 34th Ward? None of that seems to have happened. I don't know why.
You know, he has made some efforts, some of the food, so-called food deserts. He's worked to bring companies, you know, decent grocery stores, for example, into some of these poorer neighborhoods. Certainly, he's had several different police chiefs, each of which has tried some new sort of tactic. In a sense, on the policing part of it, it's a mystery nobody really has a solution for. And I feel like he has given some effort to that and a fair amount. And he, I think he recognizes the political vulnerability that he has. So I think he's given some effort. I just think that trying to solve that problem is so monumental because it really is. It's an economic problem. It's a social problem. It's not. The crime, the shooting, is only the tip of the iceberg of the bigger underlying problems, none of which have an easy solution.
Yeah, it's a hard issue to untangle, like you said. And you saw that the New York Times took a shot at the mayor for the way he's handled what possibly could or could not happen with a consent decree and police reform, an issue in which, you know, he, after what happened with Laquan McDonald, we saw, you know, a push here in the city of Chicago that we needed something to change. We saw a Department of Justice a scathing report that came out saying there needs to be training and retraining in the Chicago police force. And yet here he is in a very delicate situation, because it is delicate. He's got a new fraternal order of police head at the union there, a police contract that's coming up here, kind of waffling a bit, hoping people forgot. You know, like that seems
we got
to
be, it. We got it. Yeah. We don't need the Justice Department.
You don't need
the,
I'll take care of this.
Yeah, we got it. We got it.
And it again, I think it points to this idea that he has an image that he's not doing as much to take on an issue that's really important.
And for somebody who gets all these accolades for what great political instincts he has, to defer that to the federal government would have been a smart political thing for him to do, because then he has somebody to point fingers at if things aren't going well. The real fact of the matter is, under the current Justice Department, they're probably unlikely to actually want to execute a consent decree anyhow. So it's kind of almost that whole consent decree issue, him saying once at one point agreeing and then changing his mind once the politics change on it. That's just kind of a self-inflicted political wound by Rahm Emanuel, which goes back to your point about kind of him just sometimes having a tin ear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he still is resisting. Even the consent decree that they've sort of tried to come up with, after you have the scathing report, I think it also, you know, he doesn't want anyone meddling. He's been very abrasive when Trump has raised this on social media, when in fact we have a terrible crime problem here. I don't really care if Trump is tweeting about it. It's accurate. It's true. it's a bad deal here. But he's very controlling. He doesn't want somebody else to be able to somehow derail what he's doing or interfere. And to be fair to him, federal consent decrees are a pain in the rear. I mean, you have somebody in your face, you have somebody overregulating,
no mayor really wants that.
And he took a lot of pride in finally bringing to an end the Shachtman decree, which for years dictated who got hired for what kind of jobs in Chicago. That decree was designed to get politics out of hiring in the city of Chicago. Thank goodness that problem is solved and we no longer have politics involved in the hiring of city workers.
David is crossing his fingers as he says that. Yeah.
David Grays and Kristen McQuarrie in studio tonight. 312-981-7200. I got some texts. I'll get to you guys as well. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Overreported, underreported. It's The Download. Stay with us. All right, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. All right, let's get to overreported and underreported. I always love these categories. You know, overreported is one that's, I mean, David, you have on your list overreported what we just talked about, Emanuel and the New York media. But there's something to that. I mean, it's overreported on purpose. Like, there's this beauty in the fact that it really means absolutely nothing, and yet we love it. We love the rivalry. We love it.
Yeah, and I just the number of column inches that have been spilled on that silly little story, it just really, really struck me. Neil Steinberg in the Sun-Times today called it what is it, anger porn or something like that. It's like, it is one of those stories. You're right. We just love, but it really does add up to just about nothing.
Yeah. And that's why I love those stories too. Yeah. So I'm quizzing you on what I think the overreporting story was. So you knew this
on live radio.
You knew the state budget impasse was bad. We can't pay any of our bills. We're way behind on pensions. We have a huge unfunded liability. What was the story, do you think, in the past week where people were like, "What? You can't pay for what?" Anybody?
Lotto.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I mean, I have that on my list.
I can't believe that became the pullout of what's going to get us a budget is the lotto. We can't play Mega Millions. Can't play Mega Millions, guys. We need a budget. Everyone roll up their sleeves. We can't play Powerball. That's the dumbest story.
That's what galvanized people. Or maybe it was just the media overreporting it. We have been in the friggin' hole in this state for 7 years, maybe, trying to get a budget, trying to get our pensions funded. The second we can't pay out lottery winners or Powerball funds to leave.
No, we got kicked out of Mega Millions.
And suddenly the legislature's like getting serious. Right.
There's something to be said about that. I mean, it's funny that politics will play out, and especially in the state of Illinois, which, I mean, I put in the underreported category the fact that, you know, we saw an overreported story in Governor Chris Christie on the beach in New Jersey, right? But I thought the underreported part of that is that it was a government shutdown because they were having a budget showdown. Not unlike Maine was doing the same thing at the same time. And they had days, not months, not years. They had days to figure this out. And it made me think, wait a second. Why in the state of Illinois are we on 2+ years of doing this when Chris Christie's on the beach for a day and they got it fixed? Right. And it's because, you know, there's so many underreported things about why we don't have a government shutdown in the state of Illinois. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like even through the overreported, you know, everything that was coming out, that's the story that we should have been talking about. Why in the first place have we let lawmakers bend the rules to not hit their deadlines?
Mm-hmm. You know, if you were in a state where Chris Christie was on the beach and having pictures taken of him, you would put the government back to work too to get those beaches.
Get them out of the lawn chair.
Yeah, get them out of the
lawn
chair.
Put some clothes on the guy. Yeah.
I also had for overreported before we get to underreported, but the G20 protests. And you know, it's a big deal happening right now in Germany, the idea that, you know, they're protesting. But there was so much made that Trump this, Trump that. I don't know, from being a G8, the G8 being here in Chicago for the NATO protests and knowing, you know, wherever leaders meet, there are protests. I feel it's unfair and overreported that this has to do with Trump. I just think that there are protests every time the countries get together in any sort of form. And I felt it was a little disingenuous to act like this was a new thing, especially since, I mean, for Chicago, five years ago? Mm-hmm. When was it when McCarthy won the hearts of Chicago by beating up some hippies?
2011, 12?
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? There's always protests around summits like this.
Right.
And I felt like it was overreported. It was because of Trump.
So it's a good thing then that President Trump in Poland talked about fake news and what terrible media we have because we were overreporting protesters in Hamburg who.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
I was watching I think it was CNN, and they did. They just. It was the same B-roll over and over and over. You know, it was, you know, a few hours of people clashing with police, which, as you mentioned, we had here.
It's professional protesters.
And it's the 24-hour cable news. They literally just kept playing the same footage over and over.
Now, the weird Podesta tweets and stuff this morning, that there's been enough coverage of that's good. You're right in the sweet spot on that. But the protests, I don't agree. So. All right, so let's do underreported. As I mentioned, David, I mentioned mine, which was why there isn't a government shutdown. But you have the future of the Sun-Times, Peace and Cranes today. It's getting a little. There seems to be a lot of hyperbole being thrown around.
Well, there does, and the worrisome one, which I think is a thinly veiled threat, but nevertheless, Rapports, the company that owns the Sun-Times, have basically said that if they can't get a deal approved, either with the current bidding group, the read by former Alderman Edwin Eisendrath, or the Tronc, the company that owns Tribune, that basically they'll consider shutting down the Sun-Times. And I think that may be the first time that anybody owning the Sun-Times has gone on record with that as an option. And when people start saying things publicly, that's the time when you kind of start paying attention. Even if it appears to be a threat to get government approval for a deal, it's still kind of worrisome to hear that. And my ears perked up when I saw that in Lynn Merrick's story in Cranes today.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good one. I didn't have that one, David. But that you're right, it has been underreported. And just all the I don't really get so much of the angst about the Chicago Tribune buying the Sun-Times. I guess I'm maybe naive in believing that our people really will allow the two voices to be heard because that's in their best financial interest too. So I haven't been all worked up about the loss of the Sun-Times, but that was, you're right, that's pretty serious when they say we're going to close our doors. And we've sort of known that's coming though, right? They're really struggling, not turning a profit, laying off and not filling people. The paper itself is very thin. So maybe we shouldn't have been surprised.
Yeah.
But seeing it, yeah.
Yeah. And again, let's not get overly alarmed because it is clearly it's a negotiating tactic. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get the Justice Department to clear this deal with the Tribune, which is the best deal they have on the table. But nevertheless, when you start saying that publicly, it's time to pay some attention.
Yeah. The other story that I have for underreported and overreported, just for fun, if we wrap this up, is the Cubs. The Chicago Cubs. Oh, my gosh.
I never overreport the Cubs.
I feel like
you?
They're in overreported territory.
See my eyes rolling out of my head?
But yeah. Kyle Schwarber, you had Kyle Schwarber on an overreported. I mean, the idea of him going down to the minors and coming back and all of this.
Going 0-4.
Yeah, just having headlines about him. I mean, the paper is putting him on the front page. I mean, yes, I guess he's a star. I mean, he's the biggest star in baseball, but I don't know why. I mean, he's a guy who we love because he hit long home runs in a playoff series 2 years ago, not even in the World Series.
Right, right. Well, he had a good hit in the World Series.
Don't you guys, don't look at me. I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. I looked at Kristen to bail me out at any time. That's right, that's right. So, yeah, I think he's emblematic of, this kind of interest in every minute little twist and turn. And ironically, the Sox are in last place, and yet they're like the most interesting baseball team in town and one of the most interesting in the league right now.
You should be talking about them.
Yeah, I'll take a pass on that one. Yeah, that underreported. Yeah. Because the White Sox, for as much as I love the White Sox and what they have in their minor league system, they are also really frustrating to watch. Mm-hmm. They lose. They'll quickly, you blink your eyes, it'll be six in a row. And they are maybe a half game out of the cellar in the American League. So a lot of teams have figured out and righted their course to mediocrity, except the White Sox.
This is the last time I will be doing your show, Justin.
Hey, I'm with you. I'm a White Sox guy. I'm just saying.
I actually
this
don't
team
watch
is bad.
Them. I watched them lose up until the end of the 2015 season. I really didn't watch last year, and I haven't watched much of this year.
You're not
Can't
missing much. Although I will say, in the next couple of years, they're going to be very exciting. They got some kids that are in the minor leagues that are they have the number one baseball prospect. He's ready to come up, kid from Cuba. And then they also didn't they get the rights on another guy from Cuba when they came around. So they have a lot of talent in the minor leagues. They're just in the minor leagues. As we were talking with Kevin Powell, they show the Charlotte Knights games now on Comcast Sports. So that gives you an idea of what they're going for.
Obviously they're really playing by Theo Epstein's playbook, but maybe it'll work a second time. Who knows?
Yeah. David Greising, Kristen McQuarrie. All right, so we come back. We'll talk about stories that sucked us down the rabbit hole this week and also which stories will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week.
500.
Wow. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you. David Greising and Kristen McQuarrie here as well. We're reloading this week's news. We've done the categories, biggest story, overreported, underreported, winners, losers. We're now to my favorite category, which is which story took you down the rabbit hole? Which story did you go in and you're like, oh, I'll click on this link. And you're like, no, I better go to this. Oh, man. And now you find yourself 2-3 hours in going, wow, I didn't know that. That's the fun part about this story. And David and Kristen, of course, will probably have great stuff. David, what do you have for the story that sucked you down the rabbit hole this week?
Mine is the big hashtag CNN blackmail story. this started with a Reddit post of some old World Wrestling Federation tape of then
the matches heard around the world, right?
Donald Trump beating up some
what country?
It was Vince McMahon.
President.
He was beating up Vince McMahon in that clip.
Was that Vince
That's
McMahon?
What it was.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
yeah.
In the clip,
you wouldn't
we,
know that.
Right, in the clip we saw this week, it was the square with the CNN logo on it. So he was beating up CNN, which Apparently, according to the many stories that I then clicked through to, that went viral on the kind of conservative blogosphere.
Well, and the president tweeted it as well, which was
it was his most retweeted tweet. If you can believe that, about how epic that has to be.
This
to be
is
Donald Trump's retweeted tweet.
This is the story. What you're talking about is how it got to the point where he tweeted it. I mean, it had made the circles already. It wasn't like he just found it on a site somewhere. This was already picking up steam in the conservative.
It was picking up steam, and then CNN decided, okay, well, let's find out who created this thing originally. They found the person who created it. They talked to this person who it turned out had prior posts that had some anti-Semitic and other horrible things.
Shocker.
Young person agreed to take all that down, and CNN said, okay, we're not going to reveal your identity because you're a private citizen, which is a questionable journalistic judgment, as I've read in some of the things I clicked through on.
When
I was in the rabbit hole. And then CNN, in its explanation of giving him anonymity, said, quote, CNN reserves the right to publish his identity should any of that good stuff change. And the right-wing blogosphere thought, okay,
hashtag.
CNN is blackmailing. That's where the hashtag was born. CNN is blackmailing this guy that if he crosses the line, if he does any...
CNN do all of that after the president tweeted it, or was it was after that?
They were looking, they were trying to find out where did this all come from.
Yeah.
But then their effort to, for questionable journalistic reasons, kind of protect the identity of this person then became this horrible blot on CNN, which has had a bad go of it in the last few weeks, where they've had to kind of
What would be the reason for doing it? They just didn't want to harass this guy, like, you know, put it out there where people can.
They felt like, okay, wait, he's gone. He's taken down all his bad posts. He says he's never going to do it again. Their subsequent explanation was that they felt that in good faith he was saying he's going to do this. They didn't try to sound menacing the way they did.
Dumb question. Who cares? My point being, what did they have a right? Is they saying it was a copyright that he had it on, that he used the CNN? Cares?
No.
You're able to do that. I mean, maybe because they
started to do a story on it, and then they realized this guy did not have clean hands, and then they came up with this weird policy. Well, okay, if he does it again, then we're going to go after just really weird. Really weird stuff. Gosh. We do protect the identities of certain people when we're covering stories, but this probably would not be one of them. But maybe they felt if they contributed to him being harassed, his life was probably threatened, and they didn't want to add to that, you know?
Yeah, it used to be where my initial impulse was to scoff that his life, because usually it's the conservatives we think of as the ones who
you know
are pretty quick with the threat stuff. But after what we saw in the congressional baseball game, where a liberal took a gun and shot up a baseball game, you know, and hit
listening,
it's dangerous
it
on both
time.
Sides these days.
I think that you get this concept that for whatever reason it's a conservative social media user that's going to be someone who is vile.
Just angry.
It's debunked on this show, and people text in that there's equal opportunity vile from both sides.
There are radical elements of both parties who have shown very ugly sides of themselves since this election and during.
Well, and it leached into the Springfield events this week, where there were threats being issued. And
so the Facebook pages and people saying you have blood on your hands or something in blood. And blood. Who puts the word blood on Facebook?
I don't know. Yeah. And then somebody sprinkled white powder outside Governor Rauner's office. And so they had to put the whole Capitol on lockdown. I mean, it's gotten really ugly. But I'm guessing that was probably a liberal and not necessarily a conservative trying to mess with the governor or whatever was on schedule that day.
I wonder if what we're seeing is a sea change when it comes to CNN. They're going to take it on the chin for the idea that, you know, here they are, questionable judgment as journalists. But there is this thought about publishing names and having being responsible for the way that social media works these days, where if you make it the SNL writer, Katie, who made the Barron Trump joke, or others who make an off color thing, and it becomes a viral hit, and then it gets at their life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it starts to mess with them. And I wonder if CNN is taking a lead on saying, well, we don't need to do that. You know, like, let's just maybe we know what's going to happen. There's going to be thousands of people that are going to have some impact on this person's life who just made a dumb meme.
Right.
Let's just move on from it. And we told the story. We don't need to say the guy's name. I mean, that maybe there's a change in the way that online journalism is going.
Right. But they seem to take it from a privacy angle, whereas it seems to me that if you post something to the blogosphere, that's not really privacy.
No, it's not.
You're going public with your point of view. And I don't get the decision to, I guess, out of safety, maybe. But you could say that it's when you start making rulings on that basis, where does that stop?
Right.
When do you decide I'm going to use this person's name on that person's name?
Absolutely.
That's something journalists have tried to stay away from for many, many years.
The rule is this and do the rule, because otherwise you get caught up in this net. Wow, fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Definite rabbit hole material
for me.
A lot of time on that story.
All right, what sucked you down the rabbit hole this week,
Kristen? Is so boring, but, you know, the Democrats passed this tax hike and this budget, and they kept saying, it's balanced, it's less money than we've ever spent. So I spent quite a few hours going through a 698-page bill.
You did?
Tried looking for pork projects and where was the money balance. And it, on paper, it is a balanced budget, but it is predicated on A, B, C, D, and E happening. You know, so many people in the pension system choosing a cheaper one, the legislature also approving A, B, and C. So it's balanced as much as any other budget in state government has been balanced, which is it's not balanced. So
I mean, it's this idea that if certain money comes available, I mean, are they taking allowances on predicted revenue? I mean,
exactly.
That's a huge deal where they're like, we think, sunlight. We're going to there's more sunlight than the but then we're going to raise $10 million, like that kind of thing.
Right. They are predicting how much the new tax increase will bring in, and that usually can be somewhat of a solid number. But then as soon as they put that number out, the state's independent auditing arm put out a number saying, you know what, tax revenue is way down because people are leaving. And so, it's all just kind of jello, basically.
Yeah.
And it was a rabbit hole, and a really tedious and boring one. I'm so sorry, listeners.
That's great. Well, what are you talking about?
I didn't see you down there, but, you know, I kind of spent a little bit of time on that one myself. And, you know, some of the stuff that was interesting was they said, okay, we're going to close this $15 billion shortfall in bill payments. One way we're going to sell $6 billion worth of bonds. Oh, but by the way, we only have enough money to pay off $3 billion worth of bonds, so we're only going to raise $3 billion this way. It's like when
we're smoothing some of these numbers.
I think you'll see these behind the scenes Showtime show, The Circus, and others about campaigns being behind campaigns. But it'd be great to get a documentary show that's in the budgeting process. That is just an 8-week episode on HBO where like the state of Delaware is like, okay, let's roll up our sleeves. Let's do page 10. Because it's amazing to me, like, how they put these things together.
I mean, I've been down in Springfield before where they start out with a revenue number. We have this much money to spend. And then at midnight on May 31st, they move it. You know, we actually think we're going to get more in from cigarettes, so taxes, poor people are smoking, whatever. It's all just smoke and mirrors. So that's kind of what my rabbit hole was
all right.
this week.
My rabbit hole story, and I have two. I have the one that's the real one, and I have the one that's the – the real one was Rob Kardashian and Blac Chyna. I don't want to make a big deal about it, but I did go in the rabbit hole on that one. It was crazy. But the one we're going to talk about tonight is –
I just have to say my much younger coworker, she suggested that should be one of my overreported. I'm like, who are you – what are you talking about?
What's a Kardashian?
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you paid attention to this story?
No.
No.
Oh, come on, you guys.
Yeah, we're old
We're not hip like you.
So hip, we're not.
There's a guy Kardashian, Rob, and he was on the early shows of Keeping Up with the Kardashians with brother.
Yes.
He then went off the grid.
Yeah.
He cut the show. He was on the show, and he came back, and then he got together with an internet celebrity, her name is Blac Chyna, who was dating another rapper, Tyga. No, maybe not Tyga. I don't think it's Tyga. Might
just
be Kylie Jenner.
Just
I'm losing it.
Describing the rabbit hole he's going into.
Let me roll it back. Okay, so there's a show. It's a reality show. Anyway, there was some strange drama in which then Rob went to Instagram and he just went on this like hour-long post after post after post after post calling her out for cheating, calling her out for everything. He put up pictures that
she never would have done that to him.
No, no, of course. But there's a really interesting takeaway from it, and then we'll move on. It's just that he did all this stuff. He talked about all this private stuff. He actually posted pictures that she sent to him that were of the half-naked variety. Instagram quickly, because it was such a viral hit, everyone was there, they quickly took that stuff down. And now there are laws. There are laws in the books that you can't do that. I mean, you can get felony counts. And so lawyers are looking into whether or not Rob Kardashian broke the law by doing that, even though it's a high-profile case, and he could actually be in trouble, jail time. So,
it's a lot to take in.
All right, let's move on to something much more interesting.
I'm deleting all my nudie pictures to my phone as we speak.
There you go. Okay, so the refusal to turn over election data. That's what I had as a rabbit hole story. I did not know much about this. I thought this was a Donald Trump, you know, I thought it was mostly liberal states that were saying, we don't want to be a part of this. But as this story has evolved, 43 states have thumbed their nose to the commission on essentially Donald Trump and put together a commission that was about voter fraud when he first said that.
Chaired by Vice President Pence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened here is what 43 states have said, this is, and mostly conservative states that said, this is like our, this is what we believe in. We don't give money. It's a federalist issue. The idea that we don't give our information, state information, to the feds. And I thought it was really interesting that it's not really a political party decision. It's not liberals or conservatives. It's actually much more conservative.
Constitutional struggle here, the states' rights issue. Wow.
And Trump actually comes out and Twitter saying, what are you trying to hide? It's just really interesting because it's a lot of people supported Trump. They're just like, we don't give this kind of information to the big bad government.
Well, look at how some of the conservatives are about having like a gun database or, you know, any sort of a database that is keeping personal information on you. No way. It's a violation of liberty in their opinion. So, yeah, they're fighting back and saying, uh-uh. And a lot of the information, you could walk into any county clerk's office and get,
right,
but they're not going to give a helping hand to the Trump administration.
Yeah. I think they're just hiding those 3 million votes that Donald Trump thinks were suppressed.
Think happened? Does President Trump just let it go? Does he drop it because it's not a political, it's too much of a hot potato? There's a lot of people, I mean, I'd love the Mississippi Secretary of State, I think it was, that said, go jump in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
Last I checked, that's a Republican state. That's a red state. So it's interesting that, you know, does he drop it because, you know, now he's really kind of ticking off his Republican base?
You know, at 5 a.m. when he starts tweeting, we'll know the answer to that. I don't know. I think this was something, you know, voter fraud is something that the other side has been saying is a huge problem, and voter suppression. And I don't know, maybe if this... If he gets so much pushback, he has to drop it. What are they going to do?
Well, you know, in a way, it might actually be politically expedient for him to drop it, because it would appear that there is perhaps no basis for the claim that he has made to begin with. And so instead of actually doing a bona fide investigation and discovering that, in fact, there are not those millions of votes out there,
right,
he could just say, hey, listen, the states wouldn't let me do this.
I'm a state guy. I get it.
Those suppressed votes are out there. Yeah. If only we could prove it. Now I'm going to go and hang out with my good friend Vlad.
We'll see what the ego, if there's ego involved, or he wants to double down on the idea that he wants states to do whatever he wants.
I think his track record so far would indicate he might keep going, keep fighting it, but it might be, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
All right, Kristen McQuarrie, David Greising in studio. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll wrap it up with the story that will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 500 years from now. Black China, Rob Kardashian?
No, yeah, probably. Maybe?
All right, stay with us. All right, reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. 312 says, Governor Rauner made his wealth as a corporate raider. How does forcing the state into bankruptcy benefit anyone except the leaders who can charge higher interest? Okay. When did Illinois, 312 says, when did Illinois become a winner-take-all sport? I'm old enough to remember back to Governor Jim Thompson. Every governor was willing to work out compromises. Why is Governor Rauner different?
Those compromises were very expensive for the state.
Yeah.
So if you had some, I mean, they threw $30 billion. What was the Illinois First plan? $5 billion of pork all around, and Jack Benny statues and stained glass windows in a Naperville parking garage. When there's money around, everybody, you know, they all kind of played along. But when the money got tight, then it wasn't so easy. Yeah.
847, Mary says, I agree with the point Kristen made about Mayor Emanuel. I feel like he should make violence that plagues poor neighborhoods and particularly affects young black men a priority from day one. Instead, in December 2015, he makes a tearful speech about the Laquan McDonald shooting after the video was released. Saddens me that it took for an event for him to make mentors for young black men a priority. And I also agree that I don't care about Navy Pier or the Bean as well.
Yeah. Go Mary. With you. Mary and Kristen.
708 says, Rauner, there's a lot of governor bashing. Usually it's Speaker Madigan bashing. There's a lot.
I mean,
but tonight it's Governor Rauner brought us nothing. We lost Hostess Ford, Oreo cookies, Cocoa Puffs, Heinz Kraft merger, lost jobs.
Under Rauner?
That's what they're saying. And then 708 says, Quinn lost his job because we voted for a four-year increase, not permanent. I will never vote Democrat again. 708 says, Rauner said he would bring jobs, rich businessmen who know how to bring jobs to Illinois. He was supposed to add revenue. That's why we hired him.
I think he would say that because he hasn't been able to get his agenda done, you know, things like workman's comp and tort reform, et cetera, that's one of the reasons he hasn't had more success in bringing jobs. He might also say that he has retained some jobs that were up for bid, like the Caterpillar headquarters, moving to the Chicago suburban area. Caterpillar could well have just said, we're going, you know, out of state, et cetera.
And they
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then 608 gets the last, although 608 kind of gives it away here. My entire family of 25 is moving out of Illinois. There's your impact. You're not the only ones, including, and they're not the only ones, including all their friends. Good luck, Illinois. Greetings from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. I get emails and texts like that every day, definitely every other day.
But, you know, I almost had on my rabbit hole story was the memes about how much we actually are taxed. You know, you've seen this over and over in social media. You know, if you're comparing income tax, even with the 4.95, we're still lower than Wisconsin and other places. Now, I understand that they don't have certain taxes and we have other taxes. But when you actually suss those out, Illinois is still, it's still comparable to the other states. So the idea, like, greetings from Wisconsin. Well, as my dad who lives in Wisconsin would say, well, good luck with that.
Well,
they have the same issues. It's
6%. I believe their personal income tax is higher than Illinois.
They have a graduated income tax.
Right, yeah. But the top rate is higher than
much
Illinois.
Higher. Right, yeah. I think the issue is, I don't think people aren't objecting to necessarily paying taxes. It's just that we keep giving money to the state. You know, you're paying taxes in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Well, you have a fully funded pension system. You have bills getting paid on time. You have much more efficiency.
All right. Story we're going to remember in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50.
It's going to be just sitting here talking to you, Justin.
500 years. This segment's going to be the one they find in the toxic of Earth, and they go,
it's going to be in a time capsule.
And how
somewhere.
Do you press play on this thing? And they'll be like, hey, welcome to the download.
I kind of struggled with this one because just wasn't like some big moving story. But I mean, does the Trump-Putin meeting, will that go down in history? First time they're sitting down, world leaders. David's kind of shaking his head. I don't know.
That's a good one, though. That's historic in the way that we're
especially if something happens with Trump where he goes down in flames because of the Russian connections. That meeting will be looked at and talked about and transcribed and written about for years to come.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Well,
yeah.
And I think what you're alluding to is these when we go to the 500-year time frame.
Which Justin
it's
set
maybe
for
not
us.
Just what happens in 1 week, but what's the bigger story here? And so kind of Russia and the U.S. and the age of Trump is, especially if something happens in the domestic scene regarding the president's future, you know, that could be one. I for similar reasons, I put, even though the North Korean nuclear, intercontinental missile test itself is not something we necessarily
talk about. No, but that's one to remember,
years. But given the stakes there, that could be
the missile that was launched this week, they say had the capacity, was the first one had a capacity to actually hit Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like the
it
other
could
ones.
Draw us into war. And so,
And you hear the what's coming out of the Trump administration, sort of very, very serious things. The word things, so it's a weird word to throw into the policy.
The trouble with that whole situation is that you know, they're not the first administration to kind of shake their finger at North Korea and say, this is, you know, don't do that again. And it you know, they keep doing that and there are no real repercussions. With this president, though, you never know. I mean, he might try something other presidents have not been willing to try.
Right.
But when you have Seoul, South Korea within less than 100 miles from the border, you know, millions of people will die before the dust settles, even if it's just a conventional war situation between North and South Korea.
So I mean, it's
stakes are incredibly high.
I'll say this about, you know, I'm not paid that close attention to world politics and geopolitics and even the region, but to recognize the situation in Korea, and it's from talking to people on the show, Seoul is 40 miles from the North Korean border where there are missiles.
Mm-hmm.
It would take one incoming to wipe out hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that's always been the sticky wicket of how they negotiate, because they have missiles pointed at a mm-hmm. very, very large city, much larger than Chicago, that would be like if they had, missiles in, I don't know.
Barrington.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That makes it a lot more difficult to negotiate or to threaten any sort of, sort of military action.
And especially when North Korea, whatever their conventional weapons are not in line with what the South Koreans would have, but they just have body after body they can throw into any kind of armed conflict. It is very scary.
And I will go Black China and Rob Kardashian.
I thought you were going
to. I thought about it over the break, and I'm like, they will start the Rob and China show, and it'll be the largest rated show of all time. It'll be the biggest hit.
For 5 years, and 10 years, 500 years.
They'll get statues. They'll get an Oscar, even though it's a TV show. And then everyone will look back in 500 years when Rob Kardashian becomes president. I mean, there's a lot.
New forms of media will be invented in order to be able to kind of adequately deal with this.
The new planet that we live on and we call Kardashian. So
I nailed it.
All right. Kristen McQuarrie, she's the editorial board member at Chicago Tribune. David Greising, Midwest Bureau Chief for Reuters. You guys, thanks so much for playing tonight.
Thanks, Justin.
So fun to have you guys. I really appreciate it. All right, so let's get an update on tonight's news. Coming up, reality check. Speaking of reality television, I don't think we'll talk Kardashian, Rob Kardashian, Black China, but it is the premiere of Spouse House. Spouse House is coming up on Sunday, so reality check coming up here after the break.